The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest today is Max Blumenthal. His website is maxblumenthal.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at /Max Blumenthal. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good, good. Great to be back on.
Good to have you here, and I guess I should say you're calling from Ramallah on the West Bank, as they say.
Correct. Right, the home of the five-star occupation.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's break it down. There's some pretty surprising results, at least compared to what the newspapers were all saying from the Israeli parliamentary elections yesterday. Can you break it down? Who did what and what was so surprising?
Okay, so I was going to kind of join the what was becoming conventional wisdom and predict that not only that kind of a right-wing upstart who had headed the settlers' political lobby, their official political lobby called the Yesha Council, a 40-year-old guy named Naftali Bennett, who is a religious nationalist, who's also very appealing to Israelis, actually doesn't live in a settlement, and who wants to annex 60% of the West Bank, make it part of Israel, basically make the settlements officially part of Israel proper, who wants to deny the Palestinians a state, that's part of his platform. I was thinking that he was going to get between 14 and 16 seats and would be the second or third largest party next to Netanyahu's right-wing Likud Beitenu coalition, which he had entered into with the right-wing foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman. So I was basically ready to predict a solid right-wing, extreme right-wing bloc that would move into the governing coalition and really expose what Israel is to the outside world. And what we got instead, while Naftali Bennett and his far-right Jewish Home Party performed very well, they got 11 seats. Likud did horribly. Netanyahu got 31 seats, which makes him the biggest party in Israel, along with the coalition that he's in with Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party. But he got far less than he expected. He had expected to get over 40 seats. And for a variety of reasons, which I guess we can talk about later, he was rebuked by the Israeli public. And the person who emerged as the big winner in the election is someone that very few Americans have ever heard of. He's an Israeli broadcast TV celebrity named Yair Lapid. His father was an Israeli politician about 10 years ago. And Lapid has a newly formed party called Yesh Atid. And the American media is saying that Lapid is a centrist. The Washington Post just said, you know, his success in actually getting 19 seats in the next Knesset, making him the second largest party in Israel, gives Israel more flexibility in negotiations with the Palestinians and will make the next Israeli government more moderate. But I don't agree with that. First of all, nobody really knows what Lapid stands for. He's just this TV personality that Israelis elected because they didn't want to vote for Netanyahu, and this just seemed like an obvious choice. He's sort of a blank screen people can project their aspirations on, a lot like Obama was in 2008. But he's not a moderate towards the Palestinians. In fact, he opened his campaign at the illegal mega settlement of Ariel, and it was there that he declared, let's get rid of the Palestinians. He didn't mean eliminate them or transfer them, but he said, let's keep them behind a giant fence, which is sort of the mainstream Zionist platform. That's also kind of the platform of the Labor Party, but expressed in a much more crude way. And he talks about Arabs and Palestinians in this way consistently. In 2007, Lapid wrote an editorial for an Israeli newspaper where he said, we can never end the occupation because I will die, suggesting that the Palestinians are so endemically violent that as soon as the checkpoints and walls go away, they'll come and kill him and his family with an axe. And that was really the language he used in this column. So what I'm seeing here from my perspective, is a continuation of the status quo. And when I say the status quo, what I mean is that continuation of the strategy that Israeli prime ministers and Israeli governments have employed since the beginning of the peace process, which is to pay lip service to two states, sometimes engage in negotiations that go nowhere, to satisfy the U.S. and make Israel look like it wants peace, and to continue to build thousands and thousands of new settlement units and deepen the occupation and continue the slow-motion dispossession of the Palestinians. So this is, I think, if you, in terms of the occupation, if you're concerned about that, you're concerned about the treatment of Palestinians, I think this is actually a terrible development, because with someone like Bennett in a dominant position in the government, they'll be exposed as for not wanting peace. He says, I don't want peace. I don't want a Palestinian state. We'll continue the conflict forever. What I want is the settlements. But instead, what we get is Netanyahu with a slick-talking guy like Lapid who can appeal to Americans and say, we want peace, while they continue to do what they've been doing for the last 20 years, which is not take any positive steps towards peace and build more settlements. So this, to me, was a big victory for the status quo.
Hmm. Yeah, I definitely see what you mean there. It's sort of, I mean, it's the opposite way with the hawk and the whatnot, but it's like the Democrats having Republican secretaries of defense or whatever to protect that flank. Well, here, Netanyahu is so right-wing, he needs somebody to join his coalition. It even works out better if he has a coalition with the so-called left and center-left, because he can keep on doing right what he wants. But, well, like in America, no one will care as long as it's he's got Democrats up there with him helping, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, for the last...
That's what Bush should have done, is Bush should have hired Barack Obama to be his Secretary of State instead of Condoleezza Rice. He would have had a lot easier time in his second term.
I mean, you know, that's a point, you know, that right-wing leaders are always going to look to hire someone as their chief diplomat who can project an image of moderation to the world, but someone who's useful, someone who's a useful tool. And for the last, since 2009, Netanyahu's had Avigdor Lieberman, who, you know, Avigdor Lieberman gets up, eats his cereal, and incites, you know, belligerently and violently against Arabs. That's kind of like what he does. And he is the foreign minister of Israel. He's the top diplomat. Netanyahu could not send Lieberman to Washington. He had to basically hide him in the attic. And that's why he had Ehud Barak as his defense minister, one reason. Was because Barak could actually go to Washington and talk to the Obama administration, or they'd send Shimon Peres. So now they could potentially have, and Netanyahu, assuming Netanyahu becomes prime minister, there has to be negotiations for the coalition. But he probably will. He could have Yair Lapid, someone who really understands the international media, who's, you know, very attractive in the spotlight, as his foreign minister, you know, speaking smoothly about Israel's desire for two states, while Netanyahu continues to do what he does, and Netanyahu's party, more than ever, and this is something that really, you know, isn't being reported, but his party, more than ever, has been dominated by settlers and completely fanatical zealots like Moshe Feiglin, who won a seat on the Likud party list for the first time. Feiglin is banned from the United Kingdom for inciting racial hatred. Then there's Miri Regev, who's a top figure in Likud now, who has called African asylum seekers in Israel a cancer in the nation's body. And then there's Tzipi Hotaveli, who is like the Sarah Palin of Israel. She's 34 years old. She's in favor of annexing 60% of the West Bank. She's vehemently opposed to a Palestinian state. And when Netanyahu pays lip service to a two-state solution, Hotaveli comes out and says it was just tactical, designed to mollify the U.S. So Netanyahu is going to continue to have these problems because his party has been taken over by the settlement bloc, and all of the relatively moderate, tolerant figures from the old guard of Likud have been forced out. And that makes him, that demands someone like Lapid even more to represent Israel to the world and to preserve Israel's strategic deterrence, which depends entirely on preserving the special relationship with Washington.
Right. Well, now, it's not even necessarily a settled fact that Netanyahu will have to ally with the so-called center and left groups in order to form his government, right? He actually could stitch out a right-wing majority by a vote or two in the Knesset, no?
I think that would require him going to ultra-Orthodox party, and that would make that would weaken him politically, because there's a massive amount of resentment in Israeli society, including among religious nationalists, among the ideological settlers, for the ultra-Orthodox, because they don't perform national service or participate in the army. They're exempt from conscription, and they take up a lot of state funding. So a lot of the campaign ads you saw around Israel from different parties, but like from the Kadima party, for instance, would list the meager salary that a conscripted soldier gets versus how much the average ultra-Orthodox citizen takes from the state, since they don't really work. And so, you know, to capitalize on this resentment, there's no one better than Yair Lapid from the Yesh Atid party, because Lapid's only clear position was to force the ultra-Orthodox to perform national service or join the army. That also happens to be a position of the party I mentioned, Jewish Home, the far-right party of the pro-settler Naftali Bennett.
Right.
So they make ideal coalition partners for Netanyahu, and he'll be able to avoid bringing in the ultra-Orthodox. It's also worth mentioning that in Likud there are still liberal elements who are anti-Arab or in favor of the settlers, but they want to build a liberal Israeli society. So, for example, I interviewed the GLBT director of Likud, and he told me that it's really important that they stay out of a coalition with the ultra-Orthodox party, because that would be extremely – that would be terrible for gay citizens of Israel. So there's all this pressure on Netanyahu, and I think that will prevent him from building a completely right-wing coalition and will force him to go with Lapid.
Right. But then, like you say, there's really not much to indicate that he'll face a bunch of new pressure to create peace or give anything more than lip service to the two-state solution. It'll still just be the status quo, only, in fact, it'll be easier for him to get away with without Lieberman and without Bennett as his lightning rods.
I mean, that's my initial take one day after the election. I don't know, anything could happen, but I have a sense of the way things are on the ground here, and I just know we're in the post-Oslo, post-peace era. There is not going to be a two-state solution. It's over, and we shouldn't even talk about it anymore. It's a one-state reality. So the question is how Israel, which controls the lives of every single person between the river and the sea, including millions of Palestinians who are not allowed to vote in these elections, the question is how Israel goes about managing this one-state reality. And Benjamin Netanyahu, I mean, he's written this as early as 1993 in his first book, A Durable Peace, that Israel's goal should not be to settle the conflict. It should be to manage it and keep it at as low an intensity as possible. That's why in 2009 he started promoting his goal as the Big Quiet, which is code for a one-way peace for Israelis who live behind the wall, go to the beaches in Tel Aviv, hang out in quaint cafes in Jerusalem, and live completely separated from Palestinians, while Palestinians live under occupation and in places like where I am right now in Ramallah, they can kind of enjoy a very opulent lifestyle as long as they don't resist the factors of occupation. So that's the status quo, and Netanyahu wants to manage it while putting a lot of effort into the special relationship in Washington, telling them, reassuring them over and over again that he wants peace, leaning on the Israel lobby. And I think that is unsustainable. That kind of strategy is unsustainable because it's already being exposed. The one-state scenario is being exposed, and it's a single apartheid state. So where does that, you know, leave the right wing? The only challenge to the status quo, the most serious challenge to the status quo in Israel, is coming from the settlers and coming from right wingers like Naftali Bennett, who openly oppose a Palestinian state, want the Palestinian Authority to be disbanded and want to annex the part of the West Bank where all the settlements are, which is already under Israeli control, and place the entire West Bank under a full Israeli security umbrella, meaning Israel come back into cities like where I am now, which is, you know, controlled by Palestinian Authority security forces who coordinate with Israel. They're like the subcontractors of the occupation. But to bring the occupation back and give Palestinians in these cities both like Jordanian citizenship, while the Palestinians who live in the rural areas near the settlements get Israeli citizenship, since there are so few of them. And this is a huge challenge to the status quo, but it's gaining popularity because people are sick of endless low-intensity conflict. So I think, you know, we have to look at things beyond this election and look at them in the long term. But what we will see in the immediate future is Israel's desperate rush to preserve the status quo, and probably Barack Obama kicking the can down the road because he sees no gain in trying to push Israel back to the table. I think they know in the State Department that there never will be a two-state solution. And so it's up to Obama to really ignore this issue as much as possible.
Right. Yeah, because he can't do a thing about it. So now, you're telling me, really, there's no star, no one with any real influence in Israeli politics who says, everybody knows we got to close down these settlements and give up the West Bank. It doesn't belong to us. No one.
I interviewed the number two in the Labor Party. The person was the second, you know, listed second on the Labor Party's parliamentary list. His name is Isaac Herzog, or Bougie Herzog. He's considered like a liberal Zionist. And he told me straight up, the Labor Party favors annexing the major settlement blocks, which means, you know, they favor making, bringing, you know, between 200 and 300,000, maybe more, settlers into Israel proper. The major settlement blocks lay on top of the Palestinian aquifer, denying Palestinians 85% of their own water rights. They cut deep into the West Bank. And the Labor Party, which is, you know, the major left-of-center party in Israel, has declared their intention to annex this area. So it's not that dramatically different from what Bennett is proposing, what the religious right is proposing.
Yeah, it's just the rate.
They just want to evacuate some of the wacko ideological settlements that are further out in Hebron or Nablus and give the Palestinians kind of like a Bantustan state. So that's not going to work either. And I've heard similar rhetoric from some figures in the Meretz Party, which is the furthest left-wing party within the Zionist spectrum. So there's really only one party I know of inside Israel that calls for Israel to be a state of all its citizens. In other words, to give equal rights to non-Jews and to end the occupation. And that's the Balad party, the party of Hanin Zoabi. It's a Palestinian party. Hanin Zoabi's, you know, many of your listeners might recognize her. She was the Israeli lawmaker who was on the Mavi Marmara, on the flotilla, and was attacked in the Knesset when she returned. And the Balad party is the most hated party in Israel by non-Palestinians. Zoabi was actually attacked inside the Israeli Supreme Court during the election after she was disqualified from running for office, but the Supreme Court overturned her disqualification. So you see, there's a total opposition to removing most of the settlements among all of the Zionist parties. They will never do it. And beyond that, the international consensus for a two-state solution requires that East Jerusalem, or some part of East Jerusalem, be part of a future Palestinian capital. Mm. I can't think of any major party in Israel, in the left of center, the right of center, that supports what they call dividing Jerusalem. In other words, giving the Palestinians a capital. So that's a no-go. And these are positions that no Palestinian leader, no matter how much of a puppet they are, can accept. So, you know, just looking at the positions that these parties offered in the election campaign, it's just another reason to write off the two-state solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you this then. What the hell do they think they're doing? Because if it's de facto one state now, then that means before too long, whether in, you know, immediately like the right wing wants or eventually like the left wing wants, it will be one state. And then Jews will be a minority in that one state, and they'll rule it as an outright apartheid state, even though it's a de facto one already, but they'll rule it as an outright apartheid state for as long as that can possibly last on the American dole, which would not be very long at that point. And then what? I mean, what do they think they're doing, Max? Are they crazy or what?
Well, that's why I think the biggest problem was that they founded a Jewish state, which requires demographic manipulation and ethnic cleansing. So you have the Zionist
left. But they could pull that off if they would quit with the permanent occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, right?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the logic of a ethnocratic settler colonial state playing out. It depends on refugees and refugee camps, and it really is it's a settler state, always has been, and the settlements have always had a logical appeal, a strategic appeal to Israeli leaders. So you have left-wing Zionist parties saying, you know, this agenda of building settlements has become so dangerous, and annexation will lead to the end of the Jewish majority because we'll have to take in more Palestinians. You have to consider just how racist that logic is, because they're saying that our state depends on maintaining a majority of one ethnic group and the political supremacy of that ethnic group over another ethnic group. I mean, imagine if Rush Limbaugh, for all of the racist things Rush Limbaugh says, imagine that Rush Limbaugh came out and said, we need to fight immigration to preserve the white majority in America. Then he would, and he made that, you know, his platform. Or imagine if a political candidate in the U.S. came out and said that.
Right, that would be beyond the pale, absolutely.
He'd finally be taken off air. But this is the position of every left-wing Zionist party in Israel, including Meretz. And then you have right-wingers like who I mentioned, Naftali Bennett or Tzipi Hotzavelli, who are actually calling for annexing large parts of the West Bank. And they say we can give more Palestinians full Israeli rights because they live in these areas. I mean, these are hysterically anti-Arab figures. I'm not denying that. But I've seen them in debates with people from the Labor Party, people from the Zionist Left Party. And when the opponents on the Zionist Left tell them, well, this will destroy our Jewish majority and it's not Zionism, the right-wingers, and this is the supreme irony that I've witnessed in this campaign, the right-wingers come back and say to them, what do you have against Arabs? Why are you afraid of making Arabs citizens of Israel? And so the racism of the Zionist Left in Israel has been exposed through their opposition to taking in more Arab citizens through annexation. Of course, I think annexation itself will lead to, catastrophic circumstances. But this is the paradox of Israeli society. It says, or of the state of Israel, it says it's Jewish and democratic. There is no way that you can grant political privilege to one ethnic group, which it happens to be a settler colonial group, and maintain a democracy. It's not possible. And this is being exposed election after election for the rest of our lives. As long as there is a Jewish state, it will be exposed. And it's been exposed once again, the position of the Zionist left.
Yeah. Well, now, so just in the last few days, I got to see Five Cameras, this documentary about civil disobedience on the West Bank, and kind of renewed my curiosity about it. I don't want to go there, but since you're there on the West Bank, are you in an Israeli settlement or you're with Palestinians? And what's that like? Can you tell us about Ramallah?
Well, first of all, the documentary you mentioned, Five Cameras, I actually managed to find it on YouTube. And I think it's one of the best documentaries on the Israel-Palestine situation that I've seen in years.
So yeah, and they have it on the Pirate Bay and on Hulu and on Netflix, too. And I totally agree with you. I think it's just great.
Yeah, I mean, it really portrays the popular struggle that Palestinians have been waging since 2004 against the separation wall. It's an unarmed struggle, and it's been met with horrible violence by the Israeli army and by settlers. And you see it filmed by one of its participants, Imad Bernat. I know people from his village. I know his friends really well, and you know, they watch my videos, and they, I'm sure they'll listen to this broadcast when it's done, if we put it on Twitter, because these are really media savvy people. But I'm staying in Ramallah. It's a Palestinian city. It's kind of considered the Paris of the West Bank. There's a lot of bars and nightclubs here. It's surrounded by checkpoints and settlements. But once you're in the city, you feel like you're in this really cosmopolitan city in the Arab world. The city's economy depends on international donors. It's controlled by a Palestinian security force funded by Israel and the United States and Europe, which recently went into a refugee camp just down the street from here and shot three people during a protest against, you know, Israel's imprisonment of Palestinians. So they really are acting as subcontractors of the occupation. And you have about 400. I mean, I think this is one of the most important things that I've been following here, which will dictate what happens in the future. You have about 400,000 people in the West Bank. The population is 2 million. You have 400,000 people who are on Palestinian Authority salaries. That means their salaries are authorized basically by the U.S. Congress, which is pretty anti-Palestinian, and by the EU. And since the Palestinian Authority went to the U.N. and declared statehood, their salaries have been cut in half as a punitive measure by the U.S. and by Israel. And Israel also controls all of their, you know, taxes and import fees and everything. So you have these people on half a salary, and beyond that, there's a neoliberal economy here, which has taken root. The whole economy has been consolidated into the hands of like 10 or 15 rich guys, and everybody's living on credit. They're encouraged to buy these houses with, you know, cheap loans, which, you know, like bad loans, like the kind Americans are, you know, that created the American housing crisis.
They have a Citigroup there too.
So, you know, it's happening here too, and austerity is happening here, and people are mad, and they're not getting their paychecks. And over 50% of the Palestinian Authority's budget is for security. So these 400,000 people, who are, you know, often at the heads of families, so you have hundreds of thousands or more people dependent on them, are in security, which means they have guns. So you have a recipe for a revolution here. Because of this structure, which has been created by the U.S. and by the West to prop up an occupation. And I don't think, you know, in the near term it's going to collapse. But you could see potentially in the next few years a rebellion, a massive rebellion against the Palestinian Authority, which would require Israeli forces to step in, which could lead to a third intifada. And so this is something to watch out for, and it really, when you get out of Ramallah, which everyone calls the bubble, and you get to a city like Nablus, which is the largest Palestinian city, it's in the northern West Bank, surrounded by settlements, it's a city of full resistance. I mean, this is the city where the Intifada really happens, and they take the most casualties. You see it. When I went up there and visited there 2 weeks ago, there were street clashes every night between the Palestinian Authority and teenage kids. Whose families were, you know, suffering under this economy. So it's really the economy in the West Bank that's going to drive the next rebellion. And, you know, I don't know when it will come, but everyone knows it will come.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for time, but thank you so much for yours, Max. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Scott.
All right, everybody, that is the great Max Blumenthal. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute, writes for the Nation magazine. His website is maxblumenthal.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at @MaxBlumenthal. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. and government school why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at FFF.org. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit. Dagny & Lane at DagnyAndLane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at DagnyAndLane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.